There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Hannah Dunleavy, and I want to talk about booze. Alcohol has played a huge role in my life and is responsible for some of its highs and a lot of its lows. I'm interested in what role it plays in other people's lives and how things like age, race, class, sex, religion, geography, profession, health conditions, family history, and good old-fashioned trial and error affect what they drink and why they drink it. I'm not here to preach to anyone. I'm certainly in no position to do that. I'm just looking for a better understanding of alcohol's role in Britain in 2019. This is The Drink. Please listen responsibly. Hello, Hannah here. I know, I've hit two deadlines in a row, two Tuesday deadlines. There's never been such times. I am going to keep this bit short, though, because it's Sunday and I need to take some stuff to the tip, because that's how exciting my life is. In this episode, I talk to the brilliant comedian, author, former journalist, Jane Hill. That is coming up now. Just to let you know, I also managed to sneak out last week and catch, we didn't have a drink because she was about to go on stage, but to catch the brilliant comedian Kiri Pritchard-McLean to talk about how she is allergic to alcohol. And this evening, I'm popping out for a drink with the comedian Sean McLaughlin to talk about drinking when you're sad. That'll all be coming up in the next couple of weeks. I've got loads of other people booked in coming up. So thanks for listening, guys. And just a reminder that if you want to talk to me, I am at That Dunleavy or at The Drink Podcast. Until next week. Hi, I am here having a nice cup of tea. Well, I'm having a nice cup of tea as ever. Jane Hill, who I'm with, is having a cup of coffee. That's Jane Hill, the comedian and writer.
Yeah, I'll do.
Thanks for joining me,
Jane. Lots
of
other things, but...
Yeah, loads of things.
Loads
actually.
Of things, yeah.
You're like Stephen Fry.
Thank
can't,
you.
Can't pin you down in one area. So, you're having a coffee.
Yes.
And you're not a drinker. When was the last time you had a drink?
Other than communion wine. The last time I had a drink was on the 15th of December 2002, at about 3 in the afternoon.
That's very specific.
It is very specific, isn't it?
Now, you knew that was going to be your last drink when you had it.
Yes, I did, yes. Yes, it was my ceremonial last drink after reading a book called The Easy Way to Control Alcohol. And it says, pour yourself a drink you don't really like. So I poured myself a large tumbler of neat single malt Scotch whiskey and kind of gulped it down. And I can still remember the taste now.
Yeah, that's pretty rank.
Yeah, really. I honestly don't think. I think anyone who says they like Scotch is just pretending.
I don't like Scotch. I like whiskey. I like Irish.
Okay. So I never tried Irish. I hadn't moved on to that.
I like bourbon.
Okay.
Which is sweeter.
Yeah.
In fact, I like bourbon a lot. Tin and Do You Yep was telling me the other day that Japanese whiskey
is
quite the thing.
Ah.
But very, very expensive.
Right. So I was training myself to like Scotch originally. That's why I had a bottle, because I thought that I was the kind of drinker, the kind of sophisticated, hard-bitten, slightly blokey drinker who ought to move on to Scotch, that neat Scotch should be my drink. I felt it should be my signature drink because it just seemed the kind of person I was.
Yeah.
And so I was training myself to like it, and then I realised that it was all a thing, and perhaps that was a symptom of just how screwed up my alcohol.
That was a book by Alan Carr.
Alan Carr, the one who writes the smoking ones, not the comedian.
That.
Yeah.
So I assume that was successful for you in that you haven't had a drink since.
It was extremely successful. It was amazing. It's some kind of weird magic. I don't quite understand how it works. But I think the key thing that he does, or whoever now writes his books, because he's long dead, it's one of those, it's like James Patterson, somebody else writes the books now. But I think the key point that was made is, rather than the kind of Alcoholics Anonymous thing of one day at a time and it being a struggle, he says you're basically freeing yourself for life from the poison of drinking alcohol, and you'll never have another hangover. And that was the key, it was never having another hangover, because I can tell you every different flavour of hangover.
Yeah, well, I feel you on that, because I am, as anyone listening to this will know, I am, bad with hangovers.
Yeah.
And getting progressively worse.
Yeah.
You feel like the amount that you drink, in many ways, that hangover, your body should become more accustomed to.
Yeah, I thought, why am I still getting hangovers? Alcohol's like mother's milk to me. I should, the amount I drink, or the amount I used to drink, I should never have had a hangover.
Yeah, you feel like 14-year-old you was the person that should have gone, what the hell is that? Yeah. So, question. You mentioned the word alcoholic.
Yeah.
Is that a word that you would apply to yourself?
I do apply it to myself in a fairly loose way. And what I mean by it is that I'm a person who doesn't drink because I think if I had a drink, I wouldn't know where to stop. So if that's the definition of an alcoholic, I would say that's probably me. But I've never put it to the test. I just know that for about 8 years of my life, there were only about 5 days where I didn't touch alcohol. And that was because I was on antibiotics. And whenever I drank to excess. So if I opened a bottle of red wine at home, that bottle would be finished by the end of the evening.
So the natural conclusion is you were pissed for 8 years.
Yeah, I was basically pissed for 8 years. While holding down a really, really kind of responsible grown-up job, which I was doing every day with a hangover. And then, of course, you do it with a hangover, so the job feels more testing and more difficult and more stressful. So, of course, the first thing you do when you get home is you start drinking again, because that takes away the pressure.
Yeah.
But, of course, it adds to it as well.
Okay, so, I mean, this sounds familiar to me, because my dad was high-functioning while he worked. And then, obviously, when he didn't work, he lost routine in his life and also a bit of purpose in his life.
Yeah.
Alcohol sort of filled that void. He was able to go all day, obviously, without a drink, if there was something else to do, which sounds similar to what you're saying. A lot of people would say to me that they didn't think that he was an alcoholic because he could go for those periods, you know what I mean, without having what I would describe as a physical reaction to that. Now, you came away from drinking and you've made it sound quite easy.
Yes.
I'm assuming that you also had no physical...
I didn't have physical effects afterwards. I know that when I was drinking, I would never really start until 6 PM. You know, when I got home from work, I would open a bottle of wine or I'd go out. So I never drank before 6. And that was quite important to me because that was part of my, oh, I'm not an alcoholic because I'm not drinking during the day. But I do know I used to have to go to quite a lot of evening events in my job. I worked in local radio, so there'd be sort of evening receptions. And if it got to 8 o'clock and I hadn't had a drink yet, I would start to feel quite shaky. And I'd start to feel some quite physical symptoms, just sort of slightly sweaty, slightly shaky, just craving. So I'd like make my excuses. I actually even at one point invented a son who I used to just say to people, look, I've got to go home. My 9-year-old Kieran, he's at home, babysitter trouble. And then nobody could possibly dispute that. It seemed like a really good excuse for getting out of stuff. So I would have to go home in order to have a drink.
That shaky, itchy, that stuff, that sounds like what happens when you try and give up smoking.
But I didn't have anything at all, nothing at all physically. So this is why I think this Alan Carr stuff, it's some kind of magic thing that obviously makes your brain think in different ways. Because the first day, I remember driving to work on the first day, the first Monday, after my last drink, and just almost singing to myself because I knew I'd never have another hangover. And I felt so good. I felt incredibly healthy. I could see a sparkle in my eyes. The weight dropped off. I just felt amazingly, you know, a really amazing physical change. But I didn't get any withdrawal symptoms.
Right.
So it's interesting whether or not the 8 o'clock kind of shakes I used to get were just psychological.
Well, I mean, that does bring us on to the question. And it is true, there are different ways to be addicted to alcohol. You can be addicted to alcohol in a physical withdrawal, delirium tremors sense.
Yeah.
Or you can be addicted psychologically.
Yeah.
Now, I know people who have been both. And I would say, actually, oddly, it's the people who are addicted to it psychologically that have been the tougher people, oddly, to deal with, as in to approach their drinking.
Yeah.
Because they immediately they say, but I haven't got a problem because I can go without.
Yeah.
But when you point out that they've never gone without, when you've been in a, in a public setting, then it becomes about fun. Now, fun is...
Yeah,
you did a show called Addicted to Fun in Edinburgh.
Yeah, and I'm taking it back again this year, actually, because I did it in a really small room last year and I had to turn some people away and I felt it deserved another...
Yeah.
I'm really proud of it. But yeah, I think that I've always been somebody who's quite... Sort of all through my teenage years, I was really anxious socially, really didn't like to go out. I was that classic person. And if I describe this, I know other people, some other people will recognise this instantly and other people will think, what the hell are you talking about? That feeling where you plan to go out somewhere and you started getting ready to go out and maybe an hour or half an hour before you're due to leave home, I would just look at myself in the mirror and think, why? What on earth gave you the idea you could possibly do this? Why are you doing this? Nobody wants you there. You know, they only invited you by mistake. You've got the wrong day. I would... It was like this kind of voice of like a Victorian parent or something would appear in my head and basically tell me I couldn't go. And I spent a lot of time as a teenager in my first few years as a student turning down invitations or not turning up at stuff. And also I would get physically ill, you know, because the stomach, my stomach would turn over and I could actually make myself ill just thinking about going out. And so I think it was probably only in my early 20s when I was working for the first time and there was a kind of Friday night ritual, all going to a wine bar. This was the 80s, it was wine bar time. And it took me a few weeks to pluck up the courage to go out because I thought, they don't want me there. They're just inviting me for a joke. After a while, they kept persisting, saying, no, please come with us. So eventually I went out and I had a glass of wine and suddenly I could talk to people and it suddenly made it okay and I could be fun and I'd have another glass.
Yeah.
And I realised that people would actually want me there because I was fun. But I was only fun when I drank. And when I stopped drinking, I literally just stopped being fun again.
Yeah, that's so interesting because there's someone in my life who was like that for a really long time. They gave up alcohol because actually they had an incident with their health where they became entirely unrelated to alcohol. And they had to give up drinking it. And then they just never went back to alcohol. But I think it's something to do with when you are really sick as well. And I mean like physically sick. You get almost like a sort of a... what's it called, like a Proust's Madeleine thing about certain stuff that you're like, I can't.
Yeah.
I'm a bit like that with cider. I've never been able to drink cider after the first time I drank cider.
Yeah.
Because all I smell is vomit basically.
I find white wine really... Well, I mean, I don't drink anything now, but I could happily sniff red wine. And because that was my... It was like I'd found my soulmate.
Yeah.
You know, if I had a big romance in my life, it would be with red wine. That was my thing. Because I always felt you got a better class of hangover on red wine as well. Much more rounded and mellow. Whereas white wine, even now, the smell of white wine can just make me feel really ill because it's a very acidic-y...
Yeah, I have the opposite. I don't like the smell of red wine.
Yeah.
In fact, I had to move in a cinema a while ago because somebody had a glass of red wine.
I could have told you the grape and country.
Yeah. I bet you could.
Yeah.
That's because that was... When my dad went from being a regular drinker to an alcoholic, that's what was. It was red wine. And I'd never really thought about it until
That's interesting.
No, I can't bear the smell of that. There's something about it just smells like... defeat and failure.
I know I'm sure that I liked it because I really had this idea that drinking made me A, fun and B, sophisticated, and red wine just seemed like a kind of nice middle class thing to drink.
Oh, class, you know, and wine and is something and that's come
I definitely
up a lot on this.
You know, from my two big kind of ways of drinking were either with a big group of blokes down the pub drinking bitter, so I was a very macho kind of sexist drinker, never try and call the sort of girl drinks, or it was red wine at home, and those are my two big sort of drinking things.
Yeah.
You know, I'd really turn my nose up at cocktails or mixed drinks or... I mean, they didn't even have Prosecco when I was drinking, but now I just think, oh, I wouldn't have drunk that at all.
Yeah. Yeah, okay, so if that was your two ways of drinking...
Yeah.
And
I mean, they drank loads of other stuff as well, obviously. But
no, I mean, they both speak to me a bit because, number one, I mean, I don't think I ever... And again, this has come up a lot, women saying they would never drink a heart.
Yeah.
They felt some form of trying to keep drink for drink men around them.
I used to go up and I'd say, can I have two pints of bitter? Can we have one of them in a glass for a lady? Because it just made me laugh.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that whole thing of a half in a glass for a lady.
Yeah.
And I thought, You know, I felt as on some cutting edge of pioneering feminist drinking pints.
But the other thing you did was doing then, presumably because you live by yourself, was drinking on your own.
Oh God, yeah.
Which is something that I cannot do because it's the only rule that I've ever set myself.
Yeah, and it is a rule, isn't it? And if you look at, I always used to look at the lists of how you know you're an alcoholic. I mean, from about, you know, from a few years before I gave up, I was looking up those lists, which I think should show you, it should have shown me something. And the top thing is always, do you drink alone? And I remember my mother always saying, well, don't drink alone. But I thought, well, I live alone.
Yeah.
So seriously, what the hell am I supposed to do? Because every magazine, every newspaper article said it's absolutely fine to have a glass of red wine with your supper.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, it's not fair. You know, I'm a single person. This isn't fair. Not only do I have to pay more for holidays, not only do I get seated in a restaurant near the toilets, but I'm not allowed to drink in my own home. This is bollocks. So I'd get a bottle of red wine and I think I'll have a glass of it. And I had one of those, you know, those vacuum-in things. Those kind of there's kind of like a white suction pump. And you're, because this is how serious I was about wine.
Yeah.
You're supposed to suck out kind of the air and seal up a bottle after you've had a glass. And the amount of time I spent every evening vacuuming this thing and then think, oh, I'll have another glass. And then I thought, I'll stick to half a bottle. Because, again, that's very civilised, isn't it? That's middle class, half a bottle of red wine.
That's two cups of coffee or something.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I do that. And again, with the vacuum in and, you know, like, which you sort of pump. If anyone knows what I mean, it's this kind of pump device and it puts a little rubber seal in the bottle of wine. But if I went slightly over the half, I would have to go further because you can't leave slightly less than half a bottle of red wine because that would really offend my sense of evenness because then the next day I'd have less than half a bottle. So, of course, I'd have to finish that half bottle and then open a new one and I'd get all out of sync.
Right.
So if I went over half, I'd have to finish. And every single evening I'd fool myself into thinking I'm only going to have half a bottle of wine and virtually every evening I went over the half and had to finish the bottle of wine.
I mean, it's not the same, and I don't want to diminish it at all, but, I mean, I have the same conversation with myself about a packet of biscuits.
Of course you do. It's the same. It's exactly the same kind of thing. You think, I'm just going to have those, and I'm going to put the rest in the cupboard, and then you keep bringing it out.
Yeah.
I remember, you remember that cooking chocolate? You know that in the olden days, my mum used to have a bar of cookie chocolate.
Yeah.
She'll no idea of this at all. And I started taking squares of the cooking chocolate. And I keep making it look like she must have just used more than she'd remembered.
Yeah.
And eventually I finished the cooking chocolate, so I had to go down to the supermarket, buy a new bar of cooking chocolate, but then take off enough squares to put it back to where it was.
And cooking chocolate is vile.
It's absolutely vile, but it's this kind of impulse control thing.
Yeah, I mean,
it?
I have
and I,
no
you know, I was always like a nail biter, and it's all the kind of same. You know, I'm sure it's part of the same.
Nail biting is one of the few things I've actually broken, to be honest. One of the few bad habits.
Nail biting, but I now pick my fingers, and sometimes I pick them so badly, my fingerprints don't work on my phone. The other day, I could not get into my bank account because I'd basically bitten my fingerprints off.
Jesus.
I know. So, you know, I've stopped drinking, but that's kind of...
Well, okay, so that was going to be my...
They're self-destructive things.
That was going to be my next question. You know, you look at, I mean, a lot of people, when they give up drinking, I mean, they warn you of it, but actually there's some relatively high-profile examples of this, as in people who've given up drink, drugs, whatever. When you have one addiction and you move and you get rid of that, you quite often do move on to another one. How did you not eat all the donuts, take up smoking spliffs?
I think that one of the things that really dramatically happened when I gave up drinking. So I never had any worries about my weight. I was always very, you know, it wasn't something I ever thought about. I'd never dieted or anything. I was just very lucky. I was quite high energy, so I always kept really slim. And as a result of drinking lots of red wine and beer particularly, I had started to put the weight on. When I stopped drinking, the dramatic loss of weight was such a joy and such a significant part of me going, oh, I'm not going to drink. I think that helped with not eating the donuts.
Right.
Because it was like, oh, I hadn't even realised. I hadn't even sussed that, like, alcohol had calories in.
Yeah.
Because it's liquid. How can it make you fat? I don't understand that. Still, you know, physically, I don't. It just seems weird. So that was quite big. I tried for about 6 months. I drank so much chamomile tea that I basically must have had to have a wee about every half an hour because that really does make you.
Yeah.
I stained a teapot yellow through drinking so much chamomile tea and sort of weaned myself off it. I do you know, packs of biscuits, sweets. I do eat far more than I used to, I think. But I think it's mostly just little self-destructive habits, like, yeah, like I say, biting fingers or, you know, those kind of things that I do, yeah, now, I think, little nervous habits.
So can I ask, at what point, was there an incident that you thought this, because you said you were looking it up on the internet, mm, was there a point at which you thought, yes?
Yeah.
Was it a slow growing, like, nagging, or was there literally a point, like an incident that made you say, no, this is it, I have to stop?
It was a couple of things. I mean, I had a friend who was always my drunker friend, and that's quite a deceptive thing to have. I'm not sure that she drank that much more than me, but I could hold it together a lot more. I remember going to stay with her at a flat in Newcastle. She was living in, or she's staying in a flat belonging to a new boyfriend of hers. I remember as she let me into the flat, she said in something like, oh, it's got a burglar alarm, it's the dates of his children's birthdays, and she briefly told me the dates of the birthdays. The two of us went out in Newcastle, got absolutely slaughtered. We get back to the flat. She cannot remember the burglar alarm, but because she was sort of always seemed drunker than me, I would then suddenly almost get sober.
Yeah.
And I remembered the dates somehow from the depths of things. I put her to bed and I was convinced. I put her in the recovery position and I was convinced that she would be dead in the morning. She wasn't. She was actually up early listening to the Archers and getting breakfast. So that was nice. So I always had a drunker friend. So some part of the time I was kind of looking up almost for her. You know, is, yeah, she an alcoholic? Not am I an alcoholic? But I think I was probably fooling myself. Yeah, I mean, I went to I was invited to my boss's 40th birthday party, and there was lots and lots of really good red wine and all lovely people, you know, lots of lovely kind of well-to-do middle-class people, and I was my normal self. And I've always been frank, even when I'm sober, I will answer a question. If you ask me a question, I will give you the answer. And I was telling somebody about some sexual encounter I'd had in graphic detail, which I would do even when sober.
Yeah.
But they were really offended by this, and it all became apparently because I was drunk, and then I spilt some stuff and I nearly fell down the stairs. And I don't think I'd been any worse or behaved any differently. But when I got into work on the Monday, it was clear that something had happened, or that I'd deeply offended,
yeah,
him, his wife, and their friends. And my boss was a wonderful man. I mean, just the best boss I ever worked for. I'm very, very fond of him. And in fact, he and his wife turned up in the front row of my show in Edinburgh last year on the final day without any warning at all. So I had to slightly modify the way I told the story. But yeah, so I had to have that awful thing where you have to sit down with your boss. And he said something like, Jane, you're great. You're great at your job. Like, no, I wasn't, but he thought I was. So that was nice. And you're a really good person, but when you're drunk, you're horrible. And I think you've got a problem. And I think it probably took about 3 or 4 months from then to really sort of do something about it. And I remember waking up in a Premier Inn in Nottingham. We'd been out for our Christmas do, which was a trip to Jonglers. And ironically, at that point, I had no idea I was ever going to do stand-up. And we had been horrible, you know, like the worst drunken Christmas party. I thought I was helping. I was that drunk heckler. And, you know, getting shushed and nearly thrown out of the club. And then afterwards I was dancing amazingly well, I thought, with a complete stranger. And then as we waited for the taxi, my friend's now ex-husband started to kind of flirt with me, and we ended up snogging in front of my friend. And I woke up the next morning in a Premier Inn in Nottingham, and just before Christmas. And that's when I really thought, okay,
I'm done.
I'm absolutely done. Yeah. I nearly got thrown out of a club, and I've, you know, snogged my friend's husband in front of her.
So you were in your late 30s at this point?
Late 30s, about 38, yeah.
Okay, so question. I mean, obviously, it was very... Journalism is very boozy. I know that.
Yeah.
I've worked in journalism. Yeah. Perhaps if you'd done a different... job, maybe it might be.
Yeah, it might have been. Yeah, I do know there's a certain element of, you know, we've been talking about things like when you get a phone call in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
And there was a certain part of me that would sometimes deliberately get drunk so that if that phone call came in the middle of the night, I didn't have to deal with it.
Yeah.
Because I would be pissed. And so somebody else would then have to, you know, there's an element of like, I'm so scared of my job.
Yeah.
That if I drink, I won't have to do it.
That is interesting, because this is something we were talking about before I pressed record, which is that I had actually once had to go in at 2 o'clock and I was pissed,
yeah,
but that didn't seem to bother them because the job needed doing,
yeah.
And I think because it was important, I wasn't pissed enough that I couldn't sober up in some way that I couldn't just say, okay.
Yeah, just concentrate. Just, and just also, you wouldn't have to actually read anything out on the radio, would you?
No.
See, that was a problem.
No. Oh, there was no live.
No, I would have had to like put a microphone up and slurred. Yeah. I have got somewhere at home a recording of the very last bulletins I read early morning on a particular radio station where I decided to have my leaving due the night before my final early shift.
Oh,
and a friend just presented me the tape. She said, your mother had secretly asked me to record your last bulletins, but I'm not going to give her this tape.
Oh, my word.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss. There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Do you think... I mean, this is kind of, I don't know, maybe it's a stupid question, but do you think, bearing in mind that what you've learned about yourself,
yeah,
and do you think your life would be different if you'd stopped earlier?
I don't think so particularly. I did really well at the job I was doing, and one of the things I was really good at was schmoozing. And there was a lot of meeting people at conferences. There was a lot of...
Yeah.
There was a lot of networking. I cannot network sober. I find it really difficult. I know it sounds awful, but I think, in a sense, the time I was drinking, until it became really, really a bad thing, it was useful that
I agree.
You know, that I wasn't scared.
I don't think
scared.
Anyone likes networking
no.
sober.
No. So I think I networked a lot better through having a couple of drinks in me, although the time I went to turn to Helen Bowden, who was at the time head of BBC Radio 4, and I nearly threw up over her at 6 in the evening. That was...
Jesus.
That was a moment.
Yeah, I bet.
It was here in Cambridge, actually. We'd had one of our radio conferences. It was a marquee on a college lawn, and I'd been drinking since about 4. And I just thought, that won't be good networking. I'm just going to have to turn away and pretend I wasn't going to say anything. Keep my mouth closed. You
know? Jesus.
Yeah, so I don't think so. I think after I stopped drinking, carried on doing that job for a while, and then the key... Oh, I suppose the key thing I did, I nearly forgot this. Almost as soon as I gave up drinking, I'd been trying to write a novel for 8 years, and I finished it and got a publishing deal within a year of stopping drinking.
Wow.
I must remember that and tell myself that, because that was the other great thing that happened. You know, not just losing the weight or saving the money.
Yeah,
I actually wrote the novel I've been trying to write forever.
You learn stuff. I mean, would I have had a different dad? No.
Yeah.
Would I be a different person if he hadn't been an alcoholic? Absolutely.
Yeah.
Categorically, yes. No two ways about it. Would I be a better person? I don't know. Maybe it's because it's stuff you tell yourself.
Yeah.
But the fact that you have to have a hard shell, the fact that you have to, you know, be tolerant of people in and try and think, this isn't... I very, very rarely ever get upset with my friends for stuff they do when they're drunk, because I grew up learning that stuff will keep them.
Yeah.
So in many ways, I think, you know, it was what it was.
Yeah.
And it prepared me kind of a lesson for for how... the world is in a lot of ways. But I don't think, like you say, the confidence that you get from it when you're younger, I don't know that I would have had that confidence. So I don't think that I would, I don't know that I would have made, I certainly don't think I'd have gone into stand-up.
No.
If that had been a decision that I basically made pissed at Glastonbury.
Oh, really? Because I had to make that decision sober.
Yeah.
No, I couldn't have done it.
At Glastonbury. Yeah. I just thought, I can do this.
Yeah.
No, not I can do what they're doing. But I want to know what that feels like, I think, more to the point.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Which I don't think would have been a decision that I'd made had I just been sitting there drinking chamomile tea.
I think for me, I think what make me cross, I think, is that drink was the be all and end all. You know, when I wasn't at work, it was what I did. Yeah. And it replaced relationships, it replaced hobbies, it replaced pursuing interests for quite a long time. So I think all through my 30s, which would be the period really we're talking about, from about 30 to about 38, it was what I did when I got home from work. It was what I did.
Yeah.
And I didn't really do anything else. I mean, I went out, or I went to sort of conferences, and I was trying to write and didn't get there. I didn't have any proper relationships particularly. I think I went out with somebody for about 6 months at one point, and that was bonded over five pints of Stella. You know, yeah. I remember waking up the next morning with this guy in my bed, and I was going to him, I don't know why I've got a hangover, I only had five pints of Stella last night, and he just thought that was hysterical. And he was, somebody was like ridiculously much younger than me, and like, why I ever thought that would work. So I guess there's a certain element of being kind of, sometimes I wonder what might have happened if I had been available to pursue relationships and normal stuff. But drink was just much more important to me. You know, my bottle of red wine waiting at home was really, that's what I wanted to go home to.
Okay, so can I ask you where you think you'd be now if you hadn't stopped?
Oh, I think I would be, you know, it doesn't even bear thinking about, because I think I would have probably have lost my job. I think almost certainly, because I would have had, at some point, I was very lucky, I think, that I never got a drink drive conviction one morning.
Yeah.
You know, I did a lot of miles, and I would drive on a lot of motorway driving to visit, because I was looking after a group of about 7 or 8 radio stations at the time. So I think if I'd got a drink drive conviction, that would have been the end of my job. I would have lost the house I had then. I think it doesn't really bear thinking about what would have happened.
It wasn't sustainable.
It wasn't sustainable. No. It wasn't sustainable. I stopped at a good time for me, I suppose. You know, I don't kind of, I try not to regret things. I think that I stopped before it became, you know, really dangerous.
And I mean, presumably, you, I say presumably, because you seem to have a good relationship with your family, and you've got friends from that period. So you stopped before it became a, before
I stopped,
people were pushed out
of your life. I stopped before anyone wanted to stage an intervention. I think there's one friend of mine who, I saw her recently, an old friend from university, and she said, should I have been a better friend? Should I have, you know, pointed out to you that you were drinking too much? Because I must admit, I thought you were. I don't think my family ever noticed, because I don't, you know, I don't think I spend enough of that kind of time with them. You know, if you're with family, you do drink.
Yeah.
And that was fine, because, you know, my sister, I have a couple of beers, or beers with my brother, that was fine. But there's one friend who did sort of say, and I said, no, if you'd actually pointed it out, that would have been the worst thing in the world, because, you know, I don't need people to point out stuff to me.
Yeah.
You know, I did know. I was perfectly
but
aware.
But also, as someone
and I would have hated you for it.
Also, as someone who's pointed out to a lot of people in their life, I mean, I always feel the need to make this clear. This isn't that I think that people are an alcoholic because of, you know, because I judge people on what they drink. It's because categorically I just happen to know a crap load of them.
Yeah.
I don't.
Yeah.
Partly because I come from a big Irish family. Mm. Partly because I worked in journalism.
Yes,
I worked
exactly.
in comedy. These are areas that they do sort of amass. So it's not like I'm someone who thinks, oh, they're having a glass of wine tonight, they're an alcoholic. It's most certainly not. It's people who genuinely are starting to impact on their health. But even when you talk to them, it doesn't make any difference, Jane. Yeah. It has to come from them, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, there's somebody who, not that long ago, at a gig, and I thought, oh, God, I hope he's aware and that he's got people around him. And actually, a few weeks later, I heard that he'd given up drinking and had stayed off. You know, so you sort of felt, I don't need to say anything, but I'm just going to keep her.
Well, okay, so that's interesting, because you do have this experience. You didn't go to AA. You didn't. Yeah. You haven't. How do you have any drive in you to kind of find other people like you, or is it something best for you that's best dealt with on your own?
I'm not sure I'm always necessarily helpful. I've had sort of conversations with other people who've given up drink, but they've gone the AA route. You know, somebody said to me, would you be my sponsor? And I can't, because I don't have that kind of background. And I sort of feel like a fraud. You know, I think, oh, God, I'm not a proper alcoholic.
Yeah.
Because I sort of did it differently. I am alert to when it happens, or if somebody's drinking too much, and I guess I would, you know, in the case of the person who I saw and I realised there was an issue, it was more like, I don't know that person very well, but I'm now aware of this thing.
Yeah.
And I'm just going to, I don't know, just kind of watch and just be aware. And when he said, I'm giving up, I was like, well done, mate, you know, and I'm really pleased. And, you know, I gave up all these years ago and it can be done, and it more that kind of thing. I think it's quite, I'm only talking about it now, you know. It's like because I found it quite easy to stop, that's where I think, oh, I bet other people won't find it as easy, and that's where I feel a bit of a fraud.
Yeah.
But I couldn't have stopped any other way.
But also it's I mean, I sometimes feel that, you know, I see, and a lot recently, I think Jonathan Ashworth and Nicoa are doing a really great job. I can't tell you the amount of stuff that people have sent me saying, have you seen this, have you seen this? Like friends, people on Twitter, whatever, sending me stuff saying, have you read this? And there are articles everywhere and they're talking about it. And a lot of people have a lot worse time than I had. From the point of view of, we weren't beaten up, we weren't, you know, we weren't physically abused in any way, and therefore you think, you know, and also he had a job.
Yeah,
I mean, that didn't necessarily correlate to the idea that we have money, because obviously booze costs a lot of money.
But that thing you said about, if you've got a job, at least then you're not drinking during the day.
Yeah,
and that was my fear. So
I look at it now and I think people must look at me and go, but that's not my experience. He wasn't an alcoholic. But the key sort of thing that you share with people, that idea that you, I mean, I watched the thing that Aidan Gillen thing where he played Dave Allen.
Oh, right,
the other night.
Yeah.
And I watched it and I thought, you know, it's not the same experience, but what you look at and you see with Dave Allen is he watched somebody he loved drink himself to death.
Yeah.
And that's incredibly, that to me is the pertinent thing. Mm. That's the thing that unites us, not whether or not we got knocked about or whether or not we... The point is, we all were in that situation and we couldn't do anything to stop it. So ultimately with you, you share the same experience, which is that you drew the conclusion that it wasn't for you anymore.
Yeah, and I think one thing I note, so people who I don't think got any experience of addiction, they'll look at somebody who perhaps dies, you know, or gets himself horribly addicted to stuff, and they'll go, oh, God, they're so stupid.
Yeah.
I look at it and I think, A, there but for the grace of God, and also I still, to this day, feel a slight sense of seduction about it. I still feel, and I'm quite scared of it, that almost that sense of how simple life would be if that's all you did.
Yeah.
And I can't believe I'm saying that, but that kind of, you know, that drinking yourself to death thing is, you can, I it's awful to sort of say it, but I understand the, you know, Nicolas Cage in Leaving Las Vegas, that kind of sense of, this is what I'm going to do.
Well, I mean, absolutely correct, because my dad hasn't, he's not worrying about Brexit, he's not, you know, it's just, he made that choice, and that's what he did. And it's not the same, but I mean, I come from a small town, and I hated it.
Yeah.
It's grown on me a little bit more as I've got older, because I can see the value in small towns now. But,
yeah,
you know,
never quite, but I know what you mean.
Even so,
yeah.
I used to look at people that were my age who were happy there, and I used to think, I wish I could be happy here.
Yeah.
Because I could afford a house here, and I could, you know, just work in that local shop, and I would always be near, like, my family. And
And that just sounds like hell. Well, absolute hell.
It does,
doesn't it?
But equally, if
you could be happy with it,
if you could be happy with it, then that's the easiest.
Oh, but
there's
always that kind of question. You know, when I was a sort of a swotty girl at school and I was doing like Oxbridge entrance exam, and there's always that classic question of like, would you rather be a happy fool or a I can't remember what the
a sad
person who knows lots of stuff. I can't remember. It's like, oh, there's no question in my mind. I'd always rather be the sad genius than the happy fool. You know, it's like, I was always, as a teenager, you know, seduced by darkness and destroying yourself and, you know, poets.
Me
you know,
too,
the whole Sylvia Plath kind of Keats.
Absolutely, you know. Me too. But I assumed that's because that was the way that I sort of that's the way a lot of men in my family were. Do you know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah, I don't know where mine came from at all, because I come from an incredibly nice, normal, happy...
But you are a creative person. Yeah. And alcohol and creativity are weirdly linked.
They are linked.
In so many
they
ways.
Are linked. Unfortunately, of course, when I was drinking, I couldn't...
Be creative.
I could,
yeah.
I could be creative, but I couldn't complete...
Get it down on
I couldn't
paper.
Get it down yeah. on paper. I couldn't complete it. You know,
that's
I had
really
this kind of half-finished book forever.
So how are you around booze now? Does it I don't know, wink at you or...
No, it doesn't wink at me. I can walk up and down drinks aisles in supermarkets quite happily looking for the crisps, you know, or the tonic water or whatever.
Yeah.
I think that occasionally if I... Like I say, if I smell red wine or I see someone pouring a bottle of red wine, I think to myself, I wish I hadn't been so stupid. I wish I hadn't destroyed my ability to enjoy a glass yeah. of red wine. But actually, realistically, I never enjoyed a glass of red wine. I always enjoyed several glasses of red wine. So the idea of one glass of wine is just completely alien to me anyway.
Yeah.
So I'm fine. I don't particularly choose to go out drinking.
Partner drink?
No, not at all. Now he has absolutely no concept of the understanding of why you would get drunk at all. He just doesn't like the taste, and he doesn't like what it does to him, and his body's a temple, and it just isn't something he's ever done.
Yeah.
So that he's got that complete lack of understanding about why I would have got drunk and enjoyed it. I work in a job that involves quite a lot of travelling as well. My day job, I'm working as a trainer. It's part kind of a small team. We go to different cities and we live in hotels. And I had to make quite clear from the start, you know, I said, look, I don't like to go out with people from work after work. I'm happy at work,
yeah.
but in the evening, I just want my own time. That's not entirely true, but it's an easy way of
yeah.
saying, I know that you are, I want a meal. You know that
yeah.
very British thing where you go out and you plan to eat at some point, but you never get around to it because you're drinking.
Yeah.
I know that that's what they're going to, you know, that what I don't want to find myself is in a pub, while people getting rounds in, while I sit there with a sparkling water or a Diet Coke, and all I want to do is just go and have something to eat.
Yeah.
And they're just enjoying drinking, or they've gone to an artisan gin distillery or something. Like, what is the interest in that for me?
Yeah.
Really none.
Well, none whatsoever. Okay, so I mean...
So socially it's changed me. I don't do it, but partly because I just don't want to... And the conclusions I come to in my show, though, is the thing I really miss is, you know, the bragging?
Yeah.
You know, the bragging the next morning. Oh, my God, I was so destroyed last night. You'll never guess what I did. I threw up in a hedge and I couldn't find my house. That kind of thing.
Yeah.
I really miss that, because nobody does that a bit being sober. You know, I go
no.
out and have a lovely evening, and I go to see a nice film, and then I watch some television and I have a good meal. But nobody's interested in me bragging about how sober I was.
No, that's and to be honest, I think that's part of the sort of, I mean, I've mostly spoke to comedians and journalists on this because that's 75% of people I know for a start. But yeah, I mean, they are people who intrinsically seek out the story,
yeah.
the funny
yeah,
bit, the thing in this that
yeah.
says that. And I have, I mean, I just can't, I have yet to encounter anyone who's done as much physical damage to themselves while drunk
yeah.
as I have.
Really?
And when I think about those stories, all of those stories are funny stories. All of them I present as... I mean, I broke my toe the other day falling over the cat. And it reminded me how I broke my toe when I was about... I mean, I'd moved out of my parents' house, but
yeah.
I'd gone back for an event like that was in local. I was going to a friend of mine's... was having their child
yeah.
christened, and
yeah.
I don't generally do church, but I was like, I will go
yeah.
back to that. So I went back. I went out the night before. I got completely smashed. Stumbled back to my parents' house, which is where I'm staying. My dad was tiling their bathroom, and he had bought, not at that point,
yeah,
obviously.
Yeah, so he was halfway through,
and he was a bugger for leaving stuff lying
yeah.
around. And he had left these tiles that he got, and I'm not joking, they were about the size of this table,
right?
And they were incredibly expensive, and I'd had to look at them earlier, because
yeah.
he was so pleased with
yeah.
them. I stumble up,
oh.
and there is this enormous crack, and I thought, oh, fuck, I've broken one of those tiles. So I'm sort of stumbling around. My brother, who was young at this point, 12, 13,
yeah.
something like that, comes out of his bedroom. He's like, I mean, he's seen this sight
yeah.
many times before. I mean, he's seen both my parents' shit faces,
yeah.
seen his sister's shit faces, no big deal. And he was like, what we should do is we should, like, slice open the tile, take out the broken tile.
Yeah.
And then when he discovers, right, that there's one tile missing, he'll assume that's being Kiwi and he'll complain and I'll give him a new one. And I'm like, great idea. Yeah, yeah. So I'm pissed and we're trying to get through. And we go through this whole stack of tiles and none of them are broken.
Right? Oh, right,
none
okay, yeah.
And I was like, what was that noise then? And he suddenly went, oh my God, look at your toe. And then one of my toes was basically just pointing like upwards. Oh. It was absolutely disgusting. And at that point, didn't hurt, nothing.
No.
Next morning, I have to go to church in a pair of my brother's trainers. Because at that age, his feet were much bigger than mine were. And not the nice pair of shoes I bought because I'd smashed up my foot.
God.
Yeah, all the time. Like, or bones, lumps, bumps, what grazes, whatever. And there's nothing else. Like, falling off my bike. All the accidents that I've had in unrelated things. Mm. Booze has been a good 50% of them, I'd say.
I've been quite lucky. I got a kind of flat bit on my nose where I walked into, you know, a revolving door at a hotel in Dublin. And I misjudged where the outlet of the door was. I walked into one of the other sides. One of my friends still laughs at that, and it was like really painful. And then there was one morning after quite a heavy night, and I was going shopping, and I was going down a concrete stairs at a car park, and I fell the whole length of the thing.
It's made my stomach go cold.
Grazed my hands really badly, but the thing that happened for about 2 weeks afterwards, and I can still feel it now, 20 years on when it's cold, is I had a bruise to match every step all down my leg and on my shin. You know how shins bruise so badly? And I can tell you still where each step of that was. And that was like a morning after type deal. But yeah. But that was about it, really. That was fine. I can't think of any other injuries.
I am carnage.
I mean, there's a few nights. There was a night I slept on the back seat of my car in France because I couldn't remember how to get back into the hotel. I'd forgotten to take the little entry code with me. So I just slept in my car. I think that was probably one of the nights where I most kind of thought, oh, fuck, I'm really...
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, I've got my car, that's fine. Which is quite comfy.
So did you come from a drinking family?
No, not at all. My dad, apparently once early on in their marriage, he had come back drunk from the pub. So my mum said, you're never going back again. So he would go to the pub on Christmas lunchtime with my grandfather down the Bold Forester in Southsea, and that was it for my dad's pub life. He did homebrew, because every dad did in the 70s. The thing that I've had to check with my sister that my memory is right is we did used to have woodpecker cider with our Sunday lunch, because I think my parents thought it was a soft drink.
And like soft cider?
No, it was proper. It was woodpecker.
No, but there was
apple juice or something. And I do remember that on a Sunday afternoon, I'd always feel like I was about to explode with a tantrum.
And that's what it was.
So I think that might have been what it was. We drank a lot of homebrew, you know, when I was kind of like, 10, 11, 12 or something. My brother and I would go to swimming lessons, and I seem to remember we were allowed a shandy when we got back, which obviously you can make increasingly stronger. But it didn't really feel particularly like a drinking family. We had a Christmas, there was alcohol. We could ask, you know, it was always like, what do you want to drink? And you had to find a drink that you liked, because that's what you're going to have. But no, there was no sort of significant drinking. My older brother and sister, we would have beers. You know, if we all got together as adults, we would get a bit tipsy, you know, with a takeaway.
Yeah.
I get a bit pissed, but not significantly at all, no. I it was almost like it was my thing, it was my discovery, and it was quite a long time after leaving home, really.
My point was to do this, was to try and find some idea of what affects what people drink. Yeah. And actually, I would say the environment they grew up in, sometimes it seems pretty clear, and other times it seems to me that people like you say no background in it and then did, and then people like me, loads of background in it,
and
still
then
didn't become an alcoholic but still drank enormously and didn't put any thought into it. So I think it comes from, it's not just your family, it's wider society.
I think also my working background, you know, I mean, I was a journalist in the sort of mid 80s onwards, an era of like wine bars, or going down the pub, you know, we still went down the pub at lunchtime in those days. or you would have a beer at lunchtime and still go back and finish your job.
But Portsmouth, South Sea, I've lived there.
Yeah.
They are boozy places.
Yeah, I suppose it is. I mean, you know, it...
As in, they're set up. They're kind of set up for the old style when the Navy was coming in.
Yeah, but I mean, I never used
to. Drink.
Yeah, there are a lot of places to drink. I did not go to pubs as a teenager. I wasn't drinking at all as a teenager. You know, when people normally go out drinking. So for me, it was. Oh no! I tell you what. I think my first example of drinking heavily. So really, at home, it was from sort of early 20s onwards.
Yeah,
and that was very much a work environment thing. When I was 20, so I didn't drink a lot as a student until I was 20, and I went to America on an exchange term. I went to Dartmouth College, which is the place where the guys who wrote Animal House went. So it's got fraternities.
Yeah.
And I went for a summer term, which is like this extra term during the summer. And what the fraternities would do, they'd look at all the list of all the exchange students and pick all the women and invite them to all their parties. And we had a guy called Alastair from Edinburgh University, and they didn't realise that was a man's name, so he would get invited too. And so we'd get invited to all the fraternity parties almost every night of the week. And there would be a beer keg in the basement, and the aim of the party was just to drink the keg dry. And I think that was probably why I first just started. There was nothing else to do. I had two lectures a week at this... You're on a campus miles from anywhere. Yeah. I couldn't drive, so I couldn't get anywhere.
Where is Dartmouth? Is it Vermont?
It's in it's on the Vermont-New Hampshire border. Okay. So it's just into New Hampshire. So you're way in the back of beyond. There's one train a day goes through and stops at a place called White River Junction. And that would take you down to New York or to Boston, but it was too far to go.
Yeah.
So I was stuck on this campus with three other people from my university and a couple from Edinburgh University and all these fraternity guys. And so what else are you going to do? So that was probably where I really started to think, well, drink is a way to pass the time.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a way to have fun. It's that old thing of being a bit shy about going to parties, but if I had a drink in my hand.
So can I ask, you were using, how do I word this? I don't want to say what have you done to tackle your sort of insecurities in that sense, but what's enabling you to do it with? Because there was an underlying issue there, wasn't there?
Yeah, definitely.
So I suppose, what have you done to deal with
I don't think I have dealt with the underlying issue at all.
Well, you seem quite confident, Jess.
Yeah, I think it's just as I get older, I get more confident. I can't even tell you how nervous I get about certain things. This is fine, because it's you, and I like you and know you. I was invited to... It was a 50th anniversary party for the radio station where I worked for a while and then left. And I thought, I've got to go. I really should go to this. And it held no pleasure at all for me because all I could think about was anxiety. And as I got out of my car, I saw somebody else who I know and who I knew would be feeling a similar way.
Yeah.
Somebody who still works there and knew everybody, but I just knew... Looking at him, I thought he's going to be feeling like me. And I sort of went up to him and we walked arm in arm into the party and we both said to each other, I'm so glad I found you en route, because it gave us each somebody else.
Yeah.
I still spend an awful lot of time in loos at parties.
Really?
Yeah, because it's a safe place. You know, when you just... I've done a round of a room, found nobody to talk to and ended up back in the loo again. Oh, I hate it. Yeah, so I've done nothing. I think it's just that... if I'm there... As myself, say I'm there as a comedian, or dinner parties are okay because I know I've been invited for me.
Yeah.
My particular problem is being invited to things where I'm not sure they really mean a special invitation for me.
Okay.
I feel anxious about things where I feel I've just been invited to make up the numbers, or like they don't really want me there. But if I know that everyone is waiting to see me,
yeah,
that makes it a lot easier. That's why comedy is fine. Comedy I have no anxieties about at all, because you're the turn.
Yeah.
You've got a reason to be there. I can walk into the grottiest pub in the world. I was just remembering a gig I did in... Well, I didn't do it, because it didn't happen, in the Forest of Dean, walking into some grotty pub in, like, Fred West country, saying, hello, I'm the turn for the night, and not having any qualms at all, not feeling the slightest bit nervous, but you asked me to walk into that pub and just order a drink.
Yeah.
I wouldn't do it. I couldn't do it.
Actually, but oddly, it's easier now to be on your own, I think.
It is.
Because, you know, you've got, like, you just tit around with your phone, you go on Twitter,
It's not perhaps being on my own. I will ask questions of myself So I travel a lot on my own. I go on holiday a lot on my own. I walk into restaurants on my own. I'm very happy with it. It's more walking into a crowded room where everyone's having a good time.
Yeah.
And I think they don't actually need me here. I do not add anything to this. I don't know why they invited me.
But most of them don't either, do they?
But I just think, oh, they're all each other's friends and they don't actually like me. I still have this conviction don't like me. You know,
I get that, but it particularly manifests itself with me with Facebook groups.
Oh,
weirdly.
Okay. That's really funny.
There's a couple of Facebook groups I've had to join because they were useful in some way to my life. But I find them all to be staggeringly cliquey and I absolutely hate.
Yeah.
And if I comment on a post...
Yeah.
And nobody likes it, I think, oh, they all think I'm a fucking knob, don't they?
And do you delete the post?
Sometimes. Particularly if I think, you know, like, for example, if people are asking questions on something that involves, like, the law.
Yeah.
I mean, because I'm not an expert in the law, but I am an expert.
You're an expert
I know
on
a lot
the
about
media
the media
law,
and actually what you can post on social media does actually fall into that.
Yeah.
And I think, well, if you don't want my... if you haven't been nice enough to like my actually legally expert advice, you can fuck off. But, I find groups intimidating. Always. When I was younger, groups of women in particular, terrifying.
Oh, I still find groups of women... absolutely terrifying. You know, I said I was a bit of a blokey drinker. I remember, you know, when I was first in Lincoln, where I spent, you know, most of my drinking was done, and my biggest job was being invited round to somebody's house, you know, and it was all the women from work.
Yeah.
And I just sat there and I was like, I dressed wrong. I was too drunk. They were all talking about curtains. And I thought, I have nothing to add to this conversation. I feel completely alien. And it feels like I'd actually rather go and talk about football, which I equally well don't know that much about. But it's an easier... It felt like an easier conversation to have than
and also, in that strange way, you don't feel like you're failing if you don't know particularly about something. You know, hey, what are you guys talking about? Oh, this is... I've got nothing.
Yeah.
Because then you fall back on... you fall back on your journalism. Yeah. You just ask lots of questions.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, hey, okay.
Or humour.
Yeah. So it turns out that you like Nordic walking.
Yeah.
I don't know what that is. Tell me about it.
Yeah.
But when it's something about, I suppose...
Something that it feels like you're supposed to know about. Like they were all talking about like Delia Smith.
Yeah.
And I just... Oh,
cooking's a really good
I just went, oh, I fucking hate Delia Smith. She's a patronising cow. It turns out that's not what you're supposed to say when somebody comes out with the main course and it's Delia Smith lasagna. So I kind of, that's, you know, I'm kind of, I get outspoken in the wrong way.
Yeah.
You know, where I just upset people or I spend my time in the loo. I just can't quite do it. I just don't have the, but it's fine because the point is nobody invites me to places anymore. You know, nobody's going to invite me to like round to a party because I've got nothing to talk to anybody about.
I think we should all invite Jane to a party immediately.
Please don't. Please
Jane,
don't.
I don't think anyone has parties, particularly
That's good. Except, like, work-related Christmas dues and stuff, which I always try and be somewhere else. And I've always managed to avoid leaving parties. I've just said, no, I don't do leaving parties.
To me, the high-risk place is always a wedding. In that
I've got a wedding to go to in the summer.
Because quite often there's... And by high risk, I mean high risk of me getting absolutely leathered.
Really?
Because I have to listen to the same conversations at weddings all the time. Because I'm desperately cynical about just love and stuff like that in general.
Yeah.
And the more cynical I get, the more likely I am to have a drink, the more cynical I get. And you get into this cycle.
Yeah.
And then I start, like, how much did this fucking thing cost?
Oh, God,
you know, and all of that. But also because eventually people will then get drunk and they will get drunk and they will say to me, why have you never married? And I'm like, oh, here we are again. Here we are again. We're having the same conversation. And it might be from someone I'm actually incredibly
fond
of.
I've had that since my sister's wedding when I was 17. Yeah. They all went around and they went like this to my ticket. Yeah. You'll be next.
Yeah.
No, I won't be.
No.
No.
Absolutely. So, I find that I have to try not to get drunk at weddings because... Usually the story is, wasn't it a lovely day? Didn't we all like it? Do you remember when Hannah, la la la, and you're like,
I end up just leaving early. And then people go, oh, after you left, you never guess. And it was fantastic. And this great band played and we all had a good dance. I think I would have loved that. But there's a whole bit to get through before then.
Yeah.
And I find it very difficult to get weddings, particularly to get through the kind of bit where you're just sitting around drinking and talking before the meat of the entertainment happens. It's easier just to go.
Also, weddings are some of the few times it's acceptable to start drinking at like
like
10 o'clock
yeah,
in the morning. Yeah, people are like, oh.
That and holidays.
Yeah.
Airports.
And I'm like, okay, that'll be fine, but I'm going to need to go home at 3 o'clock if that's what happens. Someone's going to have to wake me up during the ceremony.
Yeah.
So tell me, Jane, where can people see you? Are you how well, just maybe I'll word that again. Do you know where you're going to be in Edinburgh?
Yes, I do. In fact, first off, I'm going to the Brighton Fringe. I'm doing the 1st and 2nd of June at the Carolina Brunswick.
Okay.
And then in Edinburgh, I am doing Addicted to Fun, which is my show about drinking, at the Counting House. And I think it's something like 2:15 in the afternoon. Right through the Fringe. So it's kind of early afternoon and in the loft at the Counting House all throughout the Fringe. And then I'm also in the second half of the Fringe doing a second show that haven't written yet. So, but that's going to be... Well, because I thought I don't want to just go to the Fringe and do the same show every day that I did last year.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm doing the same show every day and it's a better show and it's funny and there's more material in it. But I also want to give myself a new challenge of moving on from there.
That is a
so
challenge.
I'm doing like a work in progress show in a tiny room at the City Cafe later in the afternoon.
Excellent. Where can people find you on the social media?
Okay, I am the thing I like most is Twitter. I'm at JaneHill64, which is not my age. Well, it gives a clue to my age. Also, same address on Instagram and on Facebook. I'm Jane Hill Comedy, I think.
Okay.
But I really need to. Yeah, I need to do more with my Facebook page. Because at the moment, it's me like going, oh, yes, I'm at the Edinburgh Fringe. Here's my dates.
My Facebook page is largely me apologising for forgetting to post anything on there
exactly.
for ages.
But so Twitter's the best. That. Twitter's my best kind of...
Yeah, I always have to put the precursor out there. Yeah. I am very active on Twitter, but about 75% of it's currently about Brexit. So, you know, looking for...
Yeah, you're okay on my Twitter at the moment because MasterChef has finished. But until then, it'll be like a warning. Like, I'm mostly just going to be talking about like MasterChef and rubbish like that.
Thank you so much, Jane. It's been really interesting.
That's a pleasure. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.